So let's start. Welcome again. So I'm happy to see you again. You were obviously not horrified away, so that is nice. So perhaps a few remarks. One thing is, which I think you find it the reference on the webpage, we have there is a textbook for this lecture which you can use, which we have written ourselves. I think it is in the library. It is on virtual machines in the series of compiler construction together with Reinhard Wilhelm. So there's a kind of, I write it down, there's a kind of a textbook. Then I will put the slides. I have reworked them last time considerably. I think it's now, hopefully, I always claim that they are stable, but in the end it turns out that I always find something in it, and so nothing is stable, but I may put them onto the web page as a whole so that you can have a look at it and kind of download it. So slides, that is the other thing. Then there was the question whether you can enroll for the exercises or not. I think I asked again my Ralf. Ralf told me that you should have been automatically enrolled for the exercises when enrolling for the lecture. So, and if this has, this should be the normal case. If it has failed, then you should have noticed that in this way, that you did not receive an email by Ralf with asking you for this doodle poll on the date of the tutorials. Who has not? You have not received these? You also have not received these? How many? Once again, raise up, show up a little bit more. So please, so don't be afraid, you will not be kicked out. So, but you should send an email to Ralf Vogler. Ralf Vogler, I hope he's not with PF. Maybe, probably he's like that. I should know. He's my coworker, but actually I'm a little bit not unsure about the spelling. But you find him on the webpage and send him an email and say that you have not received this poll and that he should manually put you inside of the group. Yes? Yes. So it's the suggestion. If this does not work out for you completely, also send him an email so that he knows. So this is kind of, he kind of made an arbitrary choice, which seemed a good one for him, but whether maybe this is not a good one for you. So then please send him an email, and then he can take care of it. So yeah. Which one? What?
This class, the lecture class will be empty if it will go for exercise. The timing is the same.
It means will the exercises override the lecture, like if it's
one time. He put it at the same time?
Yeah, completely same time.
What did he do? No, it will not. Send it. Ridiculous. I have not looked up what he wrote there. So probably he didn't, he made a mistake there. What? He put the same time? Oh. Stupid. Completely stupid. So I think he will have to change that. Definitely. Thank you for the remark. Oh, man. Okay. So now for the lecture. Incredible what happens. I think we will hand out the first sheet on next Monday. And then you will have time to work on it for 1 week. So this would mean until Monday, the following Monday. And we will use the same procedure as every year, that if you manage to do a decent percentage, I guess 40%, then you get a bonus which is of one third of a mark. approximately, which is then subtracted from the result in the final exam. Yeah? So that your work is honored. Okay. More questions and more strange things happening on our web pages. So actually there was kind of a server crash somehow. Data got lost. Therefore, for some time the web pages were no longer up to date, but kind of old version has been restored. So there, it might still be the case that some things is not up to date there. So, but if you notice something, please send immediately an email so that we can deal with it. Yeah. Okay. So last time we observed the perhaps trivial fact that if we have a variable, then we a variable has two things, two meanings, if you like. In the one sense, it's kind of, it denotes a memory cell and therefore corresponds to an address. But actually, the memory cell, typically we are interested in the content of this memory cell, and this is the R value. So this is the content of the variable, and the L value, this is the address corresponding to the variable. And it is a little bit, well, maybe it is completely obvious to you, but in different contexts, there's always X. But in different contexts, you either mean just the address or just the contents, and the rest doesn't matter. And that is, well, for a single variable, this is easy to keep track of, but the same distinction also occurs in imperative languages like C. The same distinction occurs for full expressions, because an expression could be a pointer expression, and then it is a little bit subtle always to keep track whether now at this particular position the L value or the R value of the expression is meant. And it is even the case that not every expression has an L value. Some have only an R value, like if you add X plus 1, for example, then this has no L value, it has only an R value. Because you compute a value maybe it is stored somewhere in a temporary, and then it might have even an address, but typically the address is not exposed to the the programmer. In that sense, as you know, addresses correspond to pointers in C, and you can put them in, store them in pointers and do something with them. And such expressions cannot be, in this sense, you cannot put a pointer to it. Okay. So therefore, so for variables, this seems obvious and trivial, but it is kind of the concept, and we have to keep track of this distinction throughout all the language of C. Okay, yes. And therefore, now this is kind of the conceptual thing on the programming language side, but for the code generation side, and for the, we are interested in, if we have an expression, we want to generate code for it. And now, therefore, we must know whether this expression we want to have the address or whether we have to do the context, and therefore we do need two different functions to spill out the corresponding code. And this is this code L and code R. This is a function which we will define, and which takes, this function takes as an expression, a syntactical element, the expression, or the internal representation of it, and as a second argument, this the address environment. This is this row. And here note that the code generation function operates on the expression, which kind of we can envision as a structured object, so it's a kind of tree. And so a useful, if you want to express this function, a convenient way to do it is to use a functional language. So therefore, we have here adopted kind of the functional perspective to how functions are used. So in this sense, this is the function, and it takes X and row as arguments, and as you know, in functional languages, you You do not put brackets around the arguments, but you may just put them in sequence after the function. So this means code R is applied to the expression E and to row. Okay? Sometimes people get, who have never seen a functional language or a program in the functional language, get confused because they miss the brackets, and so they see three things. So what should they, what should one make sense out of it? But you could think of it as if it were something like that. Not exactly, it's not completely true, because the functions, the arguments are supplied in sequence, but in conceptually you could think code L receives E and row as arguments. Okay? Is there kind of a problem here? No. Okay. Now let us see what we, and this function we have now to define. These two functions we have to define, and here we do it. So here is code R. We want to do it apply to expressions. So expressions are built up by binary constructors in this way. And always we have to supply the row. And now our idea was the code which we generate, we first generate recursively code for the first argument here, then for the second argument, and put concatenate it. We simply put it in sequence, and then, as I tried to argue last time, the results produced when these sequences are evaluated, they return the corresponding values which are computed on top of the stack. So after execution of this code, these two values will be on top of the stack, and the only thing which we have to do is to place, to trigger the evaluation of the add, this add thing, which takes these arguments, adds them, and replaces them by the result. Okay? So that was the essence of what we said last time, and now we can also might consider the thing if there is, if we have a unary. We see here, I just wrote addition, but if we have for multiplication and all these other binary operators, it's completely the same, only that we have to replace this beast here by the corresponding instruction, which we name as we like, and I think it's mul, div, sub, so what we would like to have is three letters. Yeah? And now for if we have a unary operator, it's in the same style. We evaluate the argument, and we evaluate the argument, and then in the end, place the instruction, implementing the unary operator. That's the whole story. And one other thing is note that okay, so we have to carry around this row, which does not change here. So the variable the assignment of variable names to addresses does not change, but we need it for the argument E or the E1 and E2 because there could be variables in it. Yeah. So now what happens for the if we arrive? So that was for the complicated expressions. Now in some places we have simple expressions like there's just the constant 5. So what do we do there? So if there's a constant 5, things are very simple. We have the instruction load constant 5. And then the 5 is loaded on top of the stack. So that is also simple. Now comes the only new thing which is a variable. What do we do with a variable? How do we access the content of the variable? That's not completely clear so far because we have no instruction for it. The only thing what we have, we can do the code L for the expression X. What should that return? The address of this variable. The address is a constant, and it is stored in the row. So therefore, we simply have to do this load constant, and the which constant? This we look up in the row. Yeah, that's it. And now, but this was code L, but now code R for variable. So this is a new thing which with our current instructions we cannot handle. Why? Because we have to kind of take the value out of the box, and we have no instruction for it. And so we do, we immediately invent an instruction which helps us. What would that do? So we invent an instruction load. This instruction load expects the address of some memory cell on top of the stack, and then looks up the value there and replaces the address on top of the stack by the value, the looked up value. Yeah. So in this case, 13 is pushed on top, is replaces the address, and that. Yeah, so the operation is then simply this one. The stack pointer does not change, but we have this indirection, so we replace the address by the value. Okay? And then if we know that, then we have a nice way how to compute the value of X. So this means we first load the address of X on top of the stack, and then we load from there, by means of this super duper instruction load, which is new. Okay? Very easy. We have solved the problem. And now, we have the loading. Now comes, another kind of expression which we have not yet handled. And this is the expression X equals E. And here comes this little strange thing, which is common to C and Java, that an assignment is also an expression. So therefore, it can occur anywhere in the expression. You can X equals 5, and then additionally you can add something to it. And that is a little bit strange. What is meant here? What is the idea here? Well, the assignment really evaluates E and places the result inside the box corresponding to X, yes, but it also returns the value of the right-hand side. And somehow, I guess, it's always a conjecture, but I think the idea was that the C programmers were a little bit lazy, and if they have multiple initializations, they wanted to write something like this, to simultaneously in one go initialize multiple variables, and this you can do if you make sure that this assignment not only stores the zero but also returns the zero, and then you can put it into the X, into the Y as well, and so on. Yeah, I think this is kind of one of these things which you all know. And for that reason, this set equals zero is an expression. And now we meditate a little bit and see, we review our instructions and we see we have no possibility to write something to memory. And so we immediately feel free to invent a new instruction, and this is the store instruction. So what should the store instruction do? So in some sense, we need it for the assignment, and so in this sense, you could think of it as follows. We have this X equals E. We do the following. We first evaluate the right-hand side, the E. Then we evaluate the value which we want to store. This is the first thing which we compute. Then we compute the address for the left-hand side, and then we do whatever is needed to implement the assignment, and we don't know what to do, but we invent the store. And now in this situation, we kind of can define the store in such a way that the assignment is correctly implemented. And so the situation before application of the store is this one. First, we have the value to be stored, and then we have the address where things have to be stored. And then this means that this value here is put into this memory cell, and the pointer is popped. And you see here, and the pointer is popped. And now you see that it was on purpose that we first evaluated the right-hand side to put it downwards into the stack, and put the address, this is the value of the left-hand side, on top of it, because by this we just pop off the address, and then we still return the value of the right-hand side. So in this sense, for us it is useful and very good first to evaluate the right-hand side and then evaluate the left-hand side. This is a convenience which we like, but note also that this is not the choice of operation which is used by other compilers, for example the GCC. And this is also not the mode of operation used by Java, for example. In Java, you have the very strict rule, you evaluate from left to right everything. You also evaluate the foreign assignment, first the left-hand side, then the right-hand side. And that is, these machines do have kind of registers or things like that, and so the compiler can does it in this way. We have our machine is completely, fully a stack machine, so therefore it is convenient to do it in this way. And now you may say, okay, so that is bad. The code generation scheme is nice, but it is not what we know, and therefore it is wrong. Now, what is your answer to that? Is it wrong? Also, GCC does it differently? So,
I think it's just undefined by the C specification, so it's basically the compiler's script.
Yes. So we kind of take the liberty to exploit the unspecified semantics, the unspecified behavior of the C in the C language. So in C, it is not specified in which order the left-hand side and the right-hand side of an assignment is evaluated. And therefore we to give the compiler the freedom to do it as he likes, and so we do it. We like it in this way, so we do it in this way. In this sense, you see, code generation for C is easier than for Java because you have this freedom. On the other hand, clearly you can write code where the difference is observable. Now, what is there the answer of the C language designers? Because you could place side effects in these things. You can print to a screen somehow by placing function calls in the left-hand side and the right-hand side in the evaluation.
They just say it's undefined behavior, the program's wrong.
Yeah, yes. The program, they say, the program may not depend on such behavior, and if it does, the semantics is somehow undefined. And so this means, in principle, the compiler, if it detects, could remove these procedure calls completely or kind of abort the program or do whatever it likes. Typically compilers are not as hard. So that was this. But now, so this was this little discussion, and this is important, I guess, because this is this undefined, unspecified behavior. This is something which you might have to take, you will find when you write C programs or programs in any other language. So in some situations, you kind of assume that something is the correct semantics of your program, and in many cases it will be because compilers do it in this way typically, but then you may use a different compiler, and this compiler makes different choices, and you suddenly have different behavior, and you say there's a compiler bug. But no, it was not a compiler bug, it was an unspecified behavior of the programming language which you were not aware of. So this is a subtle source of mistakes or of errors in your code. Could be. Okay. So this was this little discussion with the store. Is there a question? Now we have made a lot of progress, and we can load and store, which is very good. Otherwise, we would not be able to do much. So let's see. Now we do a little example again. So we have here a little expression, x equals y minus 1. And we need, as I said, we need an address environment. Otherwise, we can't generate code. So if x and y have values 4 and 7, for example. So now what do we have to do? And now we simply apply our schemes manually. could easily also write a program to do it, but here we do it manually. So we have to go to the quite formalistically go to the left hand side, go to the right hand side first, evaluate y minus 1. So this means we have to descend into the first argument of the minus, evaluate that first. So for that we need the y, the value of y. So for that we have to do the this one implements getting the value of y. So we load the address of y. This is load constant 7, and then we load from there. Okay, so then we have the y. Now we have to do the 1 in order to, and then we have to subtract. To get the 1, this is just load constant 1, and then we do the subtract. And then now we have the value of the right-hand side, or the code, which computes the value of the right-hand side. Now we have to go to the left-hand side. So for there we only need the L value. So this is the address. The address of X is this one. Is obtained by this instruction, by loading the constant 4 alone. And now we have to do the assignment, and the assignment is just implemented by the instruction store. Okay? So this sequence, therefore, implements the x equals y minus 1, and having evaluated that, the value of y minus 1 will stay on top of the stack and will be returned as the result. For that, we notice a little bit one thing which is annoying, and this is that we often, our expressions will contain variables, and we will typically have to load from there or write to them. And so we will always have these kind of combinations of instruction. So loading a constant on top of the stack and then loading from there. Or loading a constant on top of the stack and then storing a value there. And this is kind of, it makes the code long, and so one might introduce a kind of abbreviation for that. So this would be this one. Instead of loading the constant and then using the general purpose instruction load, we could introduce a new instruction load absolutely from address Q, or storing absolutely into address Q. This would then correspond to this combination of two instructions. Now you may say, okay, so by that the code gets a little bit shorter. This is nice for us. We have to write less, but we have to memorize more instructions. So in this sense, this one might wonder what kind of advantage it might have. But there's another advantage, and this is if you have a new instruction for this little subsequence, you could implement the subsequence more efficiently. Instead of moving to the stack and then using there, this is a memory access, you could do a little bit of handling in some internal registers, which would make the thing much faster. So therefore, it is that introducing such more powerful instructions also makes the virtual machine faster. So therefore, it is convenient to use these. Okay, so now we know about expressions. Let us now proceed to the next complicated thing in our program, which is kind of statements and sequences of statements. So what are kind of statements? What is the simplest form of a statement? Well, the simplest form of a statement, I guess, is this one. But there's nothing to do. Yeah. So this is the no-op, and there we do nothing. But there's another slightly more complicated statement, which is if you want to really to do an assignment in C, and just do assign something, you would write x equals 1, for example, and then you make the semicolon. And please note, the semicolon makes turns the expression into a statement. This means the semicolon throws away the result which has been kept on top of the stack. Yeah. So without that, you still have the value on top of the stack, and then the semicolon turns the expression into a statement, which means it throws away the value on the stack. And this is important because kind of the idea of a statement is that it leaves the stack unchanged, at least the height of the stack. It might change variables inside, but it leaves the height unchanged. Before and after, the stack pointer is the same. So this is the key idea of the a statement. Yeah? Okay. So in order to turn it, once again, in order to turn an expression into a statement, you have the semicolon, and then the question is, how do we implement it? Well, that is very easy. You simply have to throw away the result, which is on top of the stack. So implementing this sequence or this statement E followed by a semicolon, just you implement the E. This can be arbitrarily complicated. We do it as we by this R code R schema. This function call will provide us with the sequence of instructions, and then we simply place afterwards the instruction, a new instruction, which throws away the current the topmost element of this on the stack. And this is kind of, I call it pop. Yeah? And it is very easily implemented. You simply decrement the stack pointer by one. And here we are again happy that we have all values have the same size. So if this were not the case, then you might have to decrement depending on the value. How would you determine how much you have to pop if the values have more than size 1, how would you determine that? How can the compiler find out how much to pop?
The size of the stack before executing the expression.
You could memorize the size of the stack, yes, but that would be perhaps complicated. Where do you memorize that? You can do it somehow, but the question is how would you do it? And what is your suggestion? Yeah, something, but for just a simple expression. What is, you had an idea? Based on the type. You look at the syntax and of your program, there's an expression E. And then there you have the type system. What is the type system good for? One thing is that you don't make two stupid mistakes. Yes, this is fine. But also, types provide information to the compiler about sizes of values, because if you know the expression E has type int, then you know, okay, this has size 4 or 8, yeah, and then you know, okay, now I have to pop 8. Or if you know that the type is struct, then you know the types of the components of the struct. You can evaluate the size of how your representation of a struct, how large that would be, and you pop accordingly. So therefore, this information would be exploited by CodeGen when you do this code generation here, that you kind of adjust the number of bytes to pop. Here in our simple case, currently only ints, one memory cell, therefore just one pop. But so, in this sense, later we will see more how this type information will be exploited, but here just we might kind of notice or record that this is a helpful thing. So these things with the base pointer and so that you memorize where the stack level is, this is also a useful technique which we will then later use for procedure calls. So there we use it. But here for these simple expressions, this would be a little bit overkill. Okay? Good, now we know this, how to do an assignment, and then we are happy that it's not so difficult, just having this pop. Now let's see if I have not just one statement. So the typical thing is that we have several statements in sequence. What do we do there? Now that is again something on the ER. So perhaps one more thing. You might have noticed that here I have dropped the index. Because for a statement, you don't distinguish between code left or code right. Things like there is no value to be returned, so therefore it's just code. And therefore it is a different function because it is applied to a different type of program fragment. Yeah, before it was applied to expressions, There we had two variations. Now it is applied to statements. So this is a different type of syntactical thing, and therefore a different function. So this would be kind of, yeah, this would be the way how to do it. Now, so this function, when applied to the empty sequence, then we would do nothing. And if it is applied, we spill out the empty sequence of instructions because nothing must be done. And if we have a non-empty sequence, we first put the place, generate the code for the first statement, then for the second, and so on. So that would be simply this recursion proceeding through the list of statements. Yeah. So this is the obvious thing. There's no surprise here. And I show it to you because you see that we can simply systematically try to provide these schemes, and the code generation becomes very natural. So it's nothing contrived. So it's natural. So, but these were the simple things. Yes? Yes. So here I assume that I can do pattern matching on the program syntax. So clearly on the text in the program I cannot do pattern matching, but I assume somehow that the program has been passed and you have an internal representation which makes gives a tree-like representation of the syntax, and so that I have a representation of a list of statements, and then can access the first element of this list, and so on until the last.
But the code would be overloaded for one statement and a list of statements, right?
You are right. This is true. A code is overloaded for a list of statements and a single statement, yes. Yeah, you are right. This is interesting. So in some sense, therefore, it's not lists, but somehow you can have inside a list. Inside a list of statements, you could have curly brackets and have a sublist of statements. Yes?
Can it happen that the environment is changed by the first expression?
So it could be that locally you could have... In the C language, you could write something like x equals y minus 1, and then you open a block, and for example, and then write int z, for example, like that, z equals 7, and then y equals z, and then here, and then you continue. Then in some sense, in this sub curly brackets, it's sub block, you have a different row. But when you have when you leave this block and continue afterwards, then you have the same environment as before. So therefore, the same environment is applied. So this one here is translated with one row, if you like, with one row. The next thing here, this the next statement, this thing here, is again translated with the same row. But if you descend into this block, into the curly brackets, the row changes for the internal use. And when you proceed afterwards, then the set is gone, and you have the old row as before. So the row, kind of, to answer your question again, so if you have a sequence of statements, each statement is evaluated with respect to the same row.
Yes, but if the statement S is a declaration of a new variable,
if you have a
variable
yes, so yeah, and if you have a if you have in the sequence you have declarations, then at that point the row will change. Yeah. So now let us think of we come to declarations later. Because we have to kind of take care how the row has to be changed. Okay, so then now let us look at if the control flow is a little bit more contrived, so just sequences is not so satisfactory. So for that we kind of must be able to kind of deviate from the linear. So our kind of default mode of execution was if there's a sequence of instructions, we proceed the interpreter of our virtual machine code will kind of evaluate the instructions in sequence. So this is the default mode. But sometimes we have to deviate from that. And for that we need jumps. So how would a jump be realized in our, what kind of instruction could implement a jump? So for that, the go-to or something. And here the simple idea is if you want to jump to a particular address, say A, then we simply override the PC to A. And recall that our general mode of operation, this interpretation loop, was that we first increment the PC and then execute the instruction. And now if we have this jump instruction, then this interpretation of this instruction will afterwards override the PC to A. So if it were in the opposite way around, if we interpreted the instruction first and then incremented the PC, then afterwards the PC would not have value A plus 1 and not A. So therefore first PC is incremented and then instruction is executed, and this would in this case override the PC to some value which is part of the instruction. So the jump target must be inside the code. We discussed that a little bit yesterday, that in real assembly language instructions this causes a little bit of problems since this address might be long. When doing, yeah?
But so the next instruction would be A plus 1?
No, it would be A. Because first the PC is incremented. If the PC was 5 before, it is incremented to 6. And then it is overwritten to A. And then the next instruction is fetched from A. Yeah. So this is an unconditional jump. But sometimes we also want to have conditional jumps because think of if then else is or so, then we do not know whether we will jump or not. It may depend on evaluating an expression. So in the real world, the processor provides us with some kind of flags. And then certain operations like arithmetic operations or compare operations will set the flags. And then you may jump depending on a pattern of the flag variables. And so this is complicated. We will do it simpler here. So here we kind of will have jumps in that way. We assume that there's a Boolean value or an integer value on top of the stack. And depending whether this integer value encodes a zero or not, we will jump. And so we jump, so what we will do is we typically jump at false, so this means we jump at zero. So if there is the value zero on top of the stack, we override the PC with the address in the instruction, and otherwise if on top of the stack there's something different from zero, then we do nothing. At least we do nothing in this sense, that we do not override the PC. This means that as the PC is naturally incremented before executing the jump at zero, this would mean we just continue and we would kind of execute the next instruction. So this means if this the then yeah. And another thing should be noted that we kind of our convention is that the argument is always consumed. That is the one or the zero on top of the stack will be eaten up, and so the stack decreases by jumping, by this conditional jump. It does not, the unconditional jump has no arguments, so nothing decreases, but for the jump at zero, the value on top of the stack will be eaten up. Okay, now let's see what we can do with that. So there's perhaps a little bit more of discussion which we might kind of add. So one nuisance when writing assembly code is when you have to place the absolute or the absolute numbers, the absolute addresses inside the code. And why is this a nuisance? Why is this a nuisance? Well, there you would have kind of perhaps indirect jumps, and then that would be might be a different story. But if you have to compute these addresses manually, this means, well, if your code is fixed and finished, then you know the line numbers and you place the jump targets and everything is fine. But humans do not work function in this way. Humans always change. They change here, insert a line there, forget something there, rename something there, and so on. So the code is moving around. And so it's at least during development of the code, it is the jump targets will always change. You place something there, and now you have to check which all the addresses which you have to change. And this is typically you make mistakes there. And so in the end, you will jump to somewhere, but not to the right positions. And so this is incredible. You cannot, if ever you try to do that, you never get it right. Or at least, well, I exaggerate. You get it right, but you have a hard time. So the very simple solution is that you do not write the exact numbers into the code, but use kind of symbolic labels. And then have, so now then in the end, if you do code generation like that, you give kind of symbolic names to lines, and then you jump to these symbolic labels. So this is a feature which is also provided by real programming languages. In C, you also can place these labels and make GoTos to that. And also these assembly languages typically offer you this kind of convenience. And because in the end, once the code is finished and fixed, then it is an easy thing to step through the code, to number the lines, to find, to build up a table, what kind of line number corresponds to A, B, C, and then replace all the jumps to A, B, C by these absolute numbers. Yeah. So this is a convenience which is offered by most assembly languages, assembly environments, and so we also make use of it because otherwise the code doesn't look very nice and is difficult to understand. And one makes a lot of errors. So therefore this is nice, and also it's a very simple thing, and so we always will use symbolic jump targets. We write A, B, C, and not 5, 6, 7. Another thing is, which we have discussed, even if we use ABC, then assuming that we use ABC, then still there is the question, what is then the, how do we represent, if we resolve the symbolic addresses, what addresses do we really write into the code, whether we do the absolute addresses or the relative addresses. And clearly, from a conceptual point of view, it is perhaps easier to understand that one writes at every place just the address where to jump to. But from a practical point of view, and that is what we have discussed last time, yesterday already, it is much more, from a compiler's perspective, much more convenient to supply relative jumps only. Because then the distance which you jump is much shorter you only jump, you are only allowed to jump inside a procedure or a function, and typically your functions will not have size of gigabytes or megabytes, but how large is your file? Yes, perhaps 2,000 lines, 5,000 lines, then that's it. So it's, the distance is very short. Well, assembly code could be larger, but still it is not, it is the addresses, the numbers which you have to use is much, much shorter, and therefore one practically will always use relative addresses. And it also makes the code relocatable. What does that mean? It means that you can move the code, the block for a procedure, for example, around, and this will not change. The implementation will always be the same, and will be the, because you jump only relative to the current position, and this doesn't make it doesn't care where to place it. And this is important if later on, in a later phase of your compilation, you perhaps put, you have compiled each procedure or function in isolation, and then kind of concatenate the codes and put and link them together somehow, or different object files. And that is only possible, or is much more easily possible if each one is kind of self-contained, and you do not have to kind of change all the jumps, only to put them later phase. Yeah. So therefore, relative addresses have many advantages, and so in practice, one would use that all the time. And here we keep a little bit, leave it a little bit open by using just symbolic jump targets. Okay. Okay. So that is kind of our tools, and now so here. You see, we have first thought of the instructions, and now we want to use them. But so let us see whether that works out. And so we start with the most simple form of conditional, which is just a one-sided conditional. So if an so what should be the meaning of this? Well, if E evaluates to zero, then we do nothing. And otherwise, we execute the S prime. Yeah, so that should be the case. Now, how should the code look like? So, at the first sight, we have no idea, and so we do kind of. What should we do? So, I think the general procedure, at least in my perspective, is I look for the components. Okay, there's a component E and a component S prime. And definitely, we will have to produce code for the E, and we will have to produce code for the S prime. So we have two sequences, and then we have to generate them, so they are part of the output. And then the only thing remains, what do we have to do extra to realize the if? So the control logic we have to add. Now that's the question, how it is. Now for the E, we might wonder, what kind of code do we need for the E? Clearly we need the value. So it's just the code R, because the address, we don't care. We want to know whether it's true or false. So that's it. And then we only have to insert in between, not too many jumps, so that the overall logic is realized. So let us see. So first, we said we place the codes for the two program fragments. So here they are. Now we have to start thinking a little bit more in detail. So now, after having evaluated the expression E, so what is the result? The result is that on top of the stack we have a value which is true or false, which represents true or false. So now what happens if it is false? So then we do not want to run into the code sequence for the S prime, because if the condition is wrong, we have to do nothing. So therefore, we need a jump after that, which jumps across the S prime, the code for the S prime, and continues afterwards. And now, if we place there this jump at zero, so what happens with this jump at zero if the condition was true or valued on top of the stack differently from zero? Well, then the mode of execution was just to continue. And this is nice because then we immediately here run into the code for S prime. And this is what we wanted. So it's fine. And then after the code of S prime, we simply continue. So everything is fine. So therefore, from this little discussion, we see that the right code which we should generate for this one-sided conditional looks as this. First, the code R for the E, then this jump at zero to the first position after the body of the conditional, and then simply the code for the conditional. Okay, for the then part. Okay, so that's it. And you see, it was quite easy, and so we might kind of get more. We get more confidence into ourselves, so that our approach might also work for the two-sided conditional. So let's see what we have to do there. So how does it look? So this is the form of the conditional expression. We have, again, we search for the components. This is the E, the S1, and the S2. S1 for the then part, and S2 for the else part. And again, we for each of them, we definitely will have to produce code. We place them in sequence and leave holes in between, and now try to fill them in a way so that the overall logic is satisfied. So again, we ask ourselves, what do we have to do after the expression, after having evaluated the expression? So then if the expression returns a value which is zero, so then the condition is false, then we have to jump to the else part. But the next code sequence in our output is the code for the S1. So this means, therefore, we have to jump across that and to the first address of the else part. So this is this A. So therefore, we have to jump to this A. Now, on the other hand, this is this kind of edge. Now, if the condition was not did not return zero, then the jump at zero will not jump, only consume the value of the expression, and the programming logic will continue with executing S1. The instruction afterwards, which is this S1. So this is fine. We go through that. In this thing, now we have reached the end of the then part. Now, if we would simply continue, we would run into the code for the else part, which is bad. So therefore, we have to jump across the else part. So this is this unconditional jump at the end of the then part to the first address after the else part. So, and putting all these things together, this gives us then this sequence of code. And now you see, and I like this, that it is kind of, well, it's a sequence of instructions, but it is now with our trained eyes, we notice that looking at this code, we can identify subsections, namely subsections identified by means of these two kinds of jumps. And we see the conditional jump terminates the sequence for the condition, and the unconditional jump separates the then and the else part. And with this extra information, we suddenly see that this unstructured sequence of instructions is structured, and we see the original program inside the code. Yeah? So this means with a little bit of such kind of exercise, you may look at the code which your favorite compiler has built out, and you see, this is the else, and this is the if, and and you can recognize the structure of your program inside, kind of reverse engineer the original program from the assembly code, because the code generation is such a structured and way of production. Okay. So now, now we can do a little bit more complicated expression. So this one. So here, so if x is greater than y, then y should be subtracted from x. Otherwise, x should be subtracted from y. Now, if we generate code for it, so then we it is an if-then-else. So we have jump at zero to an address, which is the start address of the else part. So this A signifies the beginning of the else part. And we have this other jump, this immediate jump B to the end point of the if-then-else. And by that, we kind of have identified the structure of the overall code. So it is an if-then-else. And then this one here, this one here should implement the condition, and this one should implement the then part, and this should implement the else part. Now for the condition, we see there's load absolute 4. This is the loading of the x, determining the value of the x. And then load absolute 7, this loads the value of y. And then we compare for greater. Okay, and now for the then part, we have, we see here, so again, if trying to do reverse engineering from the code, we see here the pop is the end of a statement, of an assignment, and of a statement, so an expression followed by a semicolon, and the same happens here. And so these are kind of a separator for a terminating symbol, if you like, for an assignment operation. And here we have the evaluation of the right hand side, and here the assignment to the left hand side. And let us look what happens on the right hand side. So load A4, this loads the value of x. Load A7, this loads the value of y, and subtracts these two values. So this gives us x minus y, and then we store it into variable x. And the same here. This one implements the right-hand side of the other assignment. So here, load A7 is the value of y. Load A4, the value of x, and they are subtracted. And this, the whole thing is assigned to the variable y. So you see here, so the code down there is equally transparent and readable in some sense as the original program. Once again? No, it will be on top of the stack. The value, these expressions, the result of these expressions are always on top of the stack. And now you have to place them into the corresponding variable and move them there. And this is by the store operation. Otherwise, it would simply be on top of the stack. And if you then do the pop, then they are simply gone. And so nothing, so this would be bad. Okay. So that was for the ifs. Now we are, our courage increases more and more, and we have now, we don't fear anything anymore. We can generate such schemes for everything what comes to our minds. So the while loops should be doable, clearly also be doable. A while loop consists of a condition and a body. and we have to produce code for both. We put them in sequence and see what we have to do. So the first thing is, when the condition is false, then the while loop is done. So therefore we jump out of the loop, that is, we jump to the first address behind. So this is this jump here, this conditional jump. If the condition is true, so that is the value on top of the stack is different from zero, then we proceed. And that is fine, because by that we kind of continue with the body of the loop. We do the body of the loop, and at the end, now what do we do at the end? At the end, we have to restart, and this we have to do always. So therefore, we need this unconditional jump to the start of the loop. So this is this unconditional jump to the beginning of the loop. And again, we see here the code for such a while loop is again very clearly structured. Again, we have these. It is starts with an address where we have to jump back, and it has a conditional jump out. This terminates the condition, the code for the evaluating the condition. Then comes the body, and the body is terminated with the unconditional jump to the beginning. And again, by looking for this pattern, we might identify while loops in the code quite easily. So if you think, for example, of this while loop, the overall structure would be, we have A, we need a label at the start point of the loop, and we need an unconditional jump to this start point at the end of the body. And then we have a conditional jump out, conditional out of the loop to the first location after the loop, which terminates the code for the condition of the loop. And so now here is the A greater than zero, so we have to get the value of A. So this is load absolute 7, and then we have to get the constant 0, load constant 0, and compare. And then, so that is for the condition. And then the body consists of two statements. These are the codes for the two statements, each one terminated with a pop. And each one, so the corresponding left-hand sides are these. And the assignments are evaluated always by these store absolute addresses, instructions, where the 9 and the 7 correspond to the C and the A. And then let us just quickly verify that this one here is correctly implements the C+1. So getting the C means load absolute from address 9. Then we load the constant 1, and then we add. And this one should be A minus B. So again, we load from A, the value of A, by loading absolutely from address 7. We load the B, from which is the same thing for address 8, and then we subtract. So this is correctly the correct implementation of this A minus B. Okay? So, and again, now we see, again we notice, in fact, with a little bit of this exercise, we can recover the original code quite easily from the generated code. Later, we will see for functional languages, this will be completely different. The code there looks so messy, so that there is no chance to recover the original code. But here, for C-like things, it is very simple. And therefore also, in some sense, this virtual machine code, the class files, are not, so if you do generate them from the Java code in a straightforward way, then there is, they are more or less in one-to-one correspondence, and you could recover the original program quite easily. Therefore, there are extra programs which are obfuscators, which try extra things to scramble up the structure, the clear structure of the compiler, in order to, so that this, that the information about the original program is as much loss gets lost as much as possible. So this is also an interesting subject, interesting exercise to write such an obfuscator, which really obfuscates. I could make kind of a competition. One group who has to obfuscate and the other group who has to de-obfuscate programs. So that would also be an interesting topic for a practical exercise. So that was while loops. And now, okay, so that is not everything. So there are also for loops. Do while loops. But they are not. So once we have one sort of loops, the other ones are. The principle is always the same. And in some sense, a for loop can be considered as a convenient abbreviation of while loops of a particular form, which is not completely true, but mostly true. So the idea, at least, of this, and probably for you all, it seems natural that a for loop has this E1, E2, E3, and one thing is for the initialization, one thing is for the condition, and one expression is for the update operation, and you feel quite free about this, how these expressions E1, E2, E3 are implemented. In these old-style programming languages like Pascal or so, for loops were much more restricted. And the C people and their followers in Java, for example, they somehow believed that initialization can take different forms depending on whether the iteration is over just an integer or whether it's over a data structure, for example. So therefore, they have allow more complicated operations there. Although I would say most people use these for loops in this very restricted forms only. Okay, so but for us, it simply means we take the E1 and place it in front of the while loop. Then the E2 is the condition, and the E3 provides the update, which means this is the operation at the end of the body. And now, once we have agreed on that that layout, we simply can use our skills to generate code for the while loop to get the code for the overall for the for loop as well. So this one would produce the code for the initialization. This is the E1 semicolon. This one is the code for the while loop, where the only specific thing is that at the end of the body we also place the code for the evaluating the E3 with the followed by the semicolon. So that's all. Yeah? And the only thing is now here this we have to be a little bit more careful about there is a distinction between these two things given as I note here by there could be a continuous statement which makes a difference. Why?
Because if you would use the continuous statement, then and translate it as an unconditional jump, the update statement wouldn't be executed anymore.
The continue for the for loop, what would that do? Where would the continue in the for loop jump to? If the S prime contains a continue, where would the jump of the continue of the for loop jump to? A3. So it would do the update, and then and where would the continue in S prime in the while loop jump to? It would, as you said, it would jump at the end of the. So here. The continue would jump there, and here the continue would jump there, and so in one the difference is whether the E3 is evaluated or not. Yeah. So therefore, in this case, one would have to the distinction matters, and that means one would have to take one would you could use this general scheme for the for loop, yes, but would have to deal then the continue operations, the continue instructions inside the body S prime differently as we would do in a similarly looking while loop. So that's the only thing. And what about the break? Would that make a difference? No, why not? Hmm? It's the break jumps out of the loop, and whether it jumps out of the one loop or the other, it would not make a difference. Yes. Okay. And there's also the do while, but I kind of spare you that one. Now let us slightly more. So now from the control structures, which we now kind of quickly review, the switch statement is the most interesting one, and also the in some sense the most challenging one, because so the switch state. What is the idea? Why do we need switch stables, switch statements at all? Why do we need them? Yes, so they are quicker, but if you want to go for speed, but also conceptually it is kind of awkward to write down if I have a case distinction on multiple things, and if I then have to organize that in a chain of if then else's, then this is extremely unintuitive and longish and ugly. So here, so that is the idea. So I have kind of I have a variable or an expression which returns an int value, and then I have for different values of this integer, I want to do different things. Now in principle, so in C, you do that such switches not only over integers, over what kind of data types you also could do it? Enums. Something else? Strings? Or characters? Characters you could do, but not strings. But characters are basically integers, and what about enums? So in essence, you only can do it over integers. So it's different in Java. There they kind of, well, originally they also had this the switch statement kind of borrowed from the C language, but then they have extended it to more complicated things. But there, I think you can switch now on enums, but enums are not numbers. Enums are objects. An enum is a type with a class type, like type, and so that they have kind of boosted the concept until one does not recognize it anymore, and it's not so clear how efficient that really is. But here in the C language, in some sense, it's just integers. But there's one, and the idea is, I think someone, you pointed it out, the point is, one wants, if I have a case distinction between many cases, and I do not, if I step through them, through all the possibilities by an if-then-else, then this takes the time I have to invest to find the right alternative, can be as long as there are can last forever. And that's not what one wants to have. Somehow one would like to see the index of the alternative and then directly jump to it. And so this means, so by our jumping on zero or not zero, this is not possible. So we need kind of a better instruction which kind of can take the value and can use this value to calculate the jump target and then jump there. So this is what one would like to have, and by that one might hope that one could jump to reach the alternative, the right alternative in constant time or in small time. So Yeah, how can we do that? So for that we need a suitable instruction and an idea how to deal with that. And the idea which people have come up with is the idea of this kind of jump table. So what is it? So assume that you have alternatives 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so that one would make a table with six entries, and at each entry one would kind of record the start point of the corresponding alternative. Because each alternative could have varying sizes, so we cannot just kind of apply an easy function to the number 2 to find where the second alternative starts. So the easiest way is to tabulate the start points of the different alternatives in this table and then jump through the jump table to the start points. That would be kind of the idea. And the value I, which kind of identifies the alternative, will be used as an index into this table. And so that would be the goal. And for that one suggestion is to provide an indirect jump. So an indirect jump consumes a value on top of the stack, which is used to jump somewhere. Now, what could it do with this value? It must kind of jump inside, or what we hear, one possibility is that you use that as an extra offset to a base address in the code. This is the base address is provided here. And that means you jump not to B, but to B plus the value you have found on top of the stack. So this means if you find 2, then you would jump to B plus 2. This is the second, third entry in this table, starting at B. That such kind of instruction might be helpful. And then now let us see how we could use it and how we could construct this jump table. And let us look at a switch statement and see what we do with it. Now, then suddenly we notice that it's not so easy because this is kind of an idealized switch statement, and the real switch statements differ from this idealized switch statement in many ways. So the first thing is the switch statement has alternatives starting from which are numbered from 0 to k minus 1 in sequence, and there's no hole. And then we also have a default which takes care for all missing cases. So the first thing is there's no reason why things should start with 0. So it could start anywhere. It's no reason why they should be ordered. It is no reason why there shouldn't be holes in between. Yeah, you could have one case 1 million and another case minus 20, and that's all, and the default. And that is a different form from this one. But let us just for the moment look at this one and then see what we would do with more general forms of switch statements. Okay, so this is kind of a puristic. This is one thing, and then there's another thing. After each alternative, I have placed these break statements. What would happen if I kind of omitted this? So one simply would continue with the next case. Yes. So it's kind of you fall through and kind of. Continue with the next case. And by that, this is kind of an, again, idealized thing, but actually what people mostly do. Very rarely people use write switch statements where after one alternative you simply proceed with the next one. This only rarely happens, but sometimes yes, and it's sometimes even a cause of errors, because people forget the break and then things happen which should not happen. Yes.
Sometimes they even put more cases together, so they put case zero.
That's true.
Case one, case
yes, 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 yes. Yeah, but in this case you could think of it that one alternative is empty and you simply continue with the next one. Yeah, yeah, that's true. So this combination of different alternatives is very useful. Yeah. And also, I think they, in principle, you could do another thing. There's no reason why the cases should be so separate on the top level, if you like, of the body of the switch statement. They could be arbitrarily inside. In some sense, they are simply jump targets. And that is makes things even, would allow you to write even uglier code and even less comprehensible and even more error prone. And therefore, I will not kind of mention that anymore. Okay, yes, please. So I repeat for the record, so whether it, the switch statements really make a difference is your question. And so I would say if you have switches with two or three, probably it doesn't make a difference. It's even maybe more expensive because you have these, it would not make a difference. But if you have cases, hundreds, or so, or for example, yeah, so then it definitely makes a difference. Okay, so let us see how we do the switch statement, and in principle, the only thing which we know for sure before starting to think at all, that we have to generate code for the EE and for all the alternatives. So, and therefore, the code must somehow look as follows. We evaluate the expression E at the beginning, somehow, and then we generate code for all the alternatives, and then we have these breaks, and these breaks kind of mean that at the end of the alternatives, we continue afterwards. So that we also can, so these are the implementation of the breaks. And then here the D is the address afterwards. So that is everything which we can write down immediately. Then I have done the following thing. I said, aha, so we need addresses. These addresses here, these are the start addresses of the alternatives and the default. This we will use. And I have kind of collected them in a list, one after the other, starting at an address B. So this is here. This is here. So therefore, this kind of constitutes this jump table. You see, when I jump to B and then relative with an index, say I, then I come to an instruction which then jumps to the right alternative. So I have two jumps instead of one. If you have a nested if then else, then you have more than two jumps, typically, or at least two jumps. So in this sense, it's no less efficient than if you do it with nested ifs, but you can do that in the worst case with these two jumps. I have now all the ingredients. The only thing which is still missing is this one here. I need some kind of code which uses the expression E and then does the right jumping. So simple-mindedly, we would kind of this check this instruction here and this at this place would simply be this jump, this indexed jump through B. But that's not the full truth. Why? Here in this case, they are ordered, but the problem is there's no guarantee that the values of E is in the range between 0 and K. E could be any, could have any value, and so we have to check for it. And we have to, in these cases where we fall out of the interval 0 to K, we have to jump to the default. And this extra calculation we have to provide. And this is what we do in this check sequence of... Now it's a little bit of hacking. We have to use our instructions to kind of hack these tests and so that we can jump to the default in all cases where the one of the cases are missing. Yes, please.
Shouldn't it be in the interval 0 to k minus 1 as k is the default statement?
Yes, but if it's k, then we also go for the default.
Okay.
But you are right. So we have to check whether it's inside the array 0 to k minus 1, and if it's outside, then we have to go to the k. Yes?
So the C0 is the default case in that false method, because otherwise the check just falls through. And
what is the CK? K is the default.
Yeah, but then if the check doesn't jump,
the check, so we will see what the check does. So I have not yet provided it. The code for the check is this one. We will see it next week. Yeah. So we have to provide a sequence which does the right thing. So if there is an index, it does the checks and then uses it to do the index jump. Yeah, that is kind of the thing. But I don't know whether I understood your question correctly. Yeah. So, but for today, I think time is over. Thank you for your attention, and we meet again in next Monday. No, not next Monday. Next Monday is... next Monday.